This is Emily Wright, Tech Editor and Head of Special Projects at EG, and we're here, day two of LREF. It's the afternoon now, and it's no less noisy out there, which is, again, excellent for networking. Everyone's clearly having a good time, but forgive the background noise. It's because this is happening right in the thick of it. So this is our global podcast, Global Real Estate Outlook. Very fitting and very interesting to hear what our expert panelists or expert podcasters have to say. So I'm joined by Sarah Hill, CEO of Greater Sydney Commission, David Inskip, Head of UK Strategy and Research at CBRE Global Investors, and Rashid Hassan, Head of Cross Border Investment at Savills. So three people I can't think of better qualified to comment on this than them. So Sarah, let's start with you. We're here talking about the global market, what's happening across the world. We're looking at technology, we're looking at innovation, business models, changes in demographics. So what indicators are there out there, do you think, beyond yields and returns, to identify up and coming opportunity areas?
Well, great question. And in fact, today we've had an incredible array of experts from around the world talking about cities such as Toronto, Tokyo, and New York. And of course, I'm here from Sydney. And some really important common trends are happening across those cities that really point to the great opportunities for investment. And a large part of that, certainly in the case of Toronto and New York and Sydney, is this incredible growth that's occurring. Many of these cities growing at 1 or 2% per annum, presenting huge opportunities for additional housing investment, generation of jobs, and a whole diversity of outcomes across our city. So yields absolutely critical for investment decisions, but also looking at those longer term opportunities for cities that are really trying to plan better, encourage more growth, more opportunities, more change, and really critically doing it better, creating the outcomes and the environments that people really want to live in.
Thank you very much. And Rashid, the same question to you.
I think that's absolutely right, but there are other factors at the moment that are driving what is making people invest and looking at the desirability of certain locations. And a lot of that, I feel, is down to interest rates and currency costs and costs of hedging. So we are seeing many people, global investors, who are looking at real estate is ultimately an income stream and an investment product that happens to be backed by real estate. And so it's really much more of a financial decision that they're making. And if you look at where yields are in mainland Europe at the moment, that is very, very linked to the cost of debt. And if you take, for example, Korean investors going crazy for Paris or for Germany, it's not only just cost of finance, it's also the fact they're getting 100 basis point positive premium on their currency. So when they're hedging their currency, so if a yield is 3%, but you get cost of debt at 1%, so your cash on cash is say 5.5%. Add on to that another 100 basis points for the hedging premium, you're at 6.5%. That's not about underlying growth in a market. That's about attractive financial return. And that trend, actually, for Australia, there's just been a move in Australia with Korean currency, where they've reduced hedging costs, and all of a sudden there's going to be more activity there, I think. And so I totally agree with what you're saying around place creation and all of those real true property factors. But I think from a global investor perspective, there are other things at play.
Very interesting point. And David, let's come to you, bringing together both of those points. Where do you stand on it?
Well, I don't think I've really got much more to add to the capital market side from what Rashid has said. I completely agree with all of that. I think when you're thinking, it really is all about returns in the end. But there are some things that at the property level will sort of precede maybe that phase, where you're looking about the place, you're looking about affordability of whatever use it is, where you're thinking about accessibility, where you're thinking about maybe even of it just being an attractive place, a place with a bit of character. Those things often precede maybe where a lot of the investors will actually enter, if you're thinking about sub-markets maybe of larger cities. And unfortunately, there's some of the things that are also harder to quantify. But I think it's ultimately about places where people want to spend their time.
Excellent navigation of delivering that brilliantly, over and under the sound of a huge announcement. Thank you very much. Some excellent points there. And let's pick up on that that idea of places where people want to spend their time, and because that's an interesting one. And I mean, Rashid, what you were saying, that, you know, it's such an excellent point and it makes so much sense, obviously, and it's, that's the financials of it. When it comes to city brands, there's another layer, I think, that people are kind of, when I say people, I mean cities, sort of almost, fighting makes it sound negative, but there is almost this competition now for city brands in a way to attract people, in the same way that companies have brands that attract people to various offices or various parts of cities. When you're looking at that city versus city competition, what kind of trends are we seeing emerging? And Sarah, can I come to you on that?
Yeah, look, it's a great question, and it's certainly a reality that cities are increasingly in this global world competing for talent, competing for investment, and certainly for a place in the good old livability index, because you know, that's very much seen as a definer of success these days. But fundamentally, it comes down to where people want to live and basically how they want to travel to work, get to school, get their kids to after school classes, all those sorts of things, and just about making life easy for people. In Sydney, so many people are attracted to not only the great employment opportunities, but the lifestyle benefits. Being able to leave work and go to the beach is a pretty good sell to a lot of people. But increasingly, housing affordability is a key driver of decision making. And likewise, what we're hearing from Sydney siders is just that importance of walkability and easy access to work. And so much of this is fundamental to how we live, but also how we invest and where we invest across not only a city but across a country. So, we're certainly experiencing differences between Sydney and Melbourne, and there's a very healthy rivalry between our two rapidly growing cities. Our trick now is to make sure that as we grow, we grow better, and we don't hinder the very things that make Sydney so attractive in the first place.
Mm. And Rashid, talking about those brands and what it is that people want and what they're looking for, do you think that there is that's kind of a universal across the world, that people want certain things out of a city? Or for investors, is it very much more looking at places by a city by city basis and working out exactly what it is that people want and whether it differs in those cities?
I think from a global shopping perspective, people are looking for comfort. They're looking for something they know and something that's familiar. And the reason that London has been such a big magnet for money from, say, Asia, from, say, Hong Kong and Singapore, because there's a legal system and a framework that's very, very similar. And you could argue the same would be money going to Australia. If you take Chinese money, the flow from China has not been to the UK as much, has been much more to the US. Likewise, Korean money. Why? Because there's a cultural affinity with it. People who have been to school there. And so when you say, oh, there's an opportunity in LA, that's a familiar piece for them, because they went to school there, or they've got nephews or family or some friends who've been to school there. And so familiarity is a big piece to it. And it sounds, I'm reducing some of these very, very important real factors with true real estate investing actually to some very much softer things or detached things from underlying real estate. When we talk to domestic investors, you talk to Land Securities about investing in London and what makes them do something. It's very much about the real estate. When you're looking at people who are doing global shopping, it is some of those softer things.
David, do you think that we're talking about alternative indicators, and it's a really interesting point, but do you think that there's maybe, I don't know whether frustration is the right word, but do you think, I'm going to use it, do you think there's a frustration of that being put forward as being such an important part of these future investments, when really, if you're looking at it, it's a financial transaction?
Well, I think it will always come back to the, from an investor's point of view, it will come back to their return target, the amount of risk that they're prepared to take able to hit that target. But these things are becoming, I don't know if increasingly important is the right way to put it, but increasingly, or maybe the importance of them is being increasingly recognized. People put a lot more value now on the livability of a place, on their wellness, and that comes from a personal level, but it's also the corporations that employ those people that are recognizing that and recognizing that it's important to them. So it's filtering all the way through the system in that way.
Mm. I do think this is an important point. when you get into it, the people that pay, this is a financial investment, this is what people are doing for return, but the people that pay your rent are your tenants and those companies, and the companies need to be employing people that want to be there, and you need to, as an investor, you need to be creating spaces that tenants want to be in, or residential that people want to live in, etc. Those are very, very important points when it comes to successful real estate.
And I'd add to that that point about risk, and you know, certainly there is a risk involved in development, and there's a risk involved in investment. And I think the more that we can give that certainty, whether it be through the planning process or around the branding and the amenity of an area, you know, the more that we can and encourage and support the outcomes of those that investment. And I think that's a really critical element for the city planner. And the challenge for the city planner is always this tension between having that certainty and that certainty of direction and that certainty of regulatory environment, as well as the flexibility and the flexibility to recognise that cities are growing and evolving, markets are changing, and certainly the expectations of lifestyle are changing as well. And how we work with all of those factors certainly keeps me in a job.
Thank you very much. And we've touched on the occupiers and the tenants and that being so important in terms of attracting talent. So let's just go one step back about, you know, attracting the big name occupiers. We've looked into that a lot over the last 18 months or so, and who the occupiers are that everybody wants, why they're the occupiers that everybody wants, and how much power do they actually have. And it should come as no surprise that at the moment a lot of those names tend to be big tech company names. Is that something that we see continuing? Will these be, you know, these current draw tenants that seem to put a city on the map, is that always going to be the case? Can I come to you, Rashid, on that first?
I suppose as a city planner or as a talk to the City Corporation in London, then they will want a diverse range of occupiers. It's good for business to have diversity. As an owner of a building, I don't think you are necessarily as maybe it's not a luxury to have to say I want this type of tenant, I want this type of tenant, and I wouldn't say at the moment that tech is a more attractive tenant type to have than say a professional services firm. It's down to financial covenants of success and the belief that the business will be a sustainable and long-term business. The biggest change in the last, take for London, the biggest change in the last 10 plus years has been this growth of tech occupiers. Obviously that's been fundamental in the City of London in particular, but then also this co-working theme, and everyone talks about WeWork and everything else. And they are the biggest occupier in London after the government. Same in New York, and they are. If you go back 10 years, 15 years, where you were doing a development, you wouldn't want to. There would be exclusions around having serviced offices in your buildings. Today, it's actually a very important element in a building, because it offers amenity. It offers potentially small businesses that are going to grow into bigger occupiers. They're an important part of the tenant landscape, which weren't there before.
Thank you very much. And David, same question to you around the power of the occupier when it comes to investment decisions into cities.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've seen very clearly in the US with the example of Amazon that cities are very keen to get those very large tech occupiers in. But really, it's a function of their own growth, that it is those companies now that require more space than anyone else. I think maybe it's a bit of a risk when governments and planners think too far ahead about what maybe the next growth area is and try and plan to deliberately attract those people. But what you do generally see with those big occupiers coming in, establishing their campuses, and they do like to have specific requirements. If you look, for example, at Google in London taking space around King's Cross, and especially Apple taking space at Battersea Power Station, which isn't an established submarket. They clearly want to create something special there for themselves. And there will be other businesses that pop up around there and spin off from that. And it will be a driver of future growth as well.
Sarah, you're nodding along there.
Yeah, no, I think there's sort of two components there I absolutely agree with, which I'd like to build on. I certainly think there is a great merit in attracting some of those big names, and I was sort of wondering how long Google and Apple would take to come into the conversation. And I know internationally, you know, there's certainly a lot of competition to attract those key tenants and really use them as a catalytic effect for an area more generally to bring in those associated and clustered organisations that sort of spin off from that. But I absolutely agree with the point too. There's something quite magical and very attractive about that organic tenant and kind of growth of an area. And I talk about it often in a Sydney context of this street called Dang Street. It was a former industrial area in Green Square that's been regenerating, and no planner or property investor or anyone really with great intent could have planned the effect that happened of quite simply a really popular restaurant moving into an area on the back of that. There subsequently over a series of years was a whole series that came together and created this incredible lifestyle and attractive and lively environment that that thrived in an area. And that was just really an organic and kind of unique experience that subsequently spun off and really attracted a lot of Sydneysiders to it. I wish I could replicate it elsewhere in the city, but it was a magic thing that you really can't plan for.
And that's interesting that the things that you can't plan for, and there's I don't know if you've been to the LX factory in Lisbon, which I'm a huge fan of, but sort of a similar story there with an entire kind of district that was meant to be one thing and became something else and has been hugely successful. And it is quite nice, I think, to see this sort of serendipitous development happening within cities that really changes an area. I'm interested to hear from you all, and it's very difficult to ask people to predict the future. In fact, it's impossible to ask people to predict the future, but we can always have a go at looking at where we might be heading next. And when it comes to up and coming opportunities and where sort of future interests might be, I'm interested to see what you guys think in terms of specific cities or also sectors, whether there are any sectors emerging as the ones to watch. And I'm looking around to see who's thinking the most and who I'm going to pick on. David.
Yeah, I don't mind taking this one. I'll take it more from a sort of sector and property type angle than a city angle, though. And I think there's lots of sort of new alternative sectors emerging at the moment. Some of them that we've thought of as emerging sectors aren't really anymore, like student accommodation and hotels, which are well established in the mainstream now. But you look at the news just this week, and we've heard about Ocado investing a lot of money in vertical farming. And I mean, who'd even heard of vertical farming before this week? I know I hadn't, but it seems like something where there's potential. But I think a lot of the emerging sectors are around residential, around the trends of population growth, in particular urbanisation, and what that's meant for affordability. There are things coming through like co-living. I'm not sure how well that will work in all cities. I'm sure there will be times when it will work, but times when it won't really be culturally appropriate. But an area that we definitely really like and see a lot of growth in is affordable housing. So just last year we launched an affordable housing fund in the UK, and we've seen an incredible amount of investor demand for that coming partly from the traditional property investor base, but also from pure social impact investors as well. So those things around ESG, how important that is to people, they're really moving up people's agendas, and I think that's going to be an area that sees a lot more growth.
Brilliant, thank you very much. And Rashid, the same question to you.
I think close to home, London, within London, I think the City of London, the core City of London, is looking reasonable on an office basis. I think rents are low. And I think the opening of Crossrail, you said what changes an area at the beginning, those first questions. Infrastructure is a massive, obviously, influence. And Crossrail is going to, I think, cause core city rents to rise. Stepping out of that in terms of other cities or countries, I think, are important. China. I think look at a place like Shenzhen or the Greater Bay Area of Greater China. The opportunities and the growth that sit in that economy in those cities is electric. India as well. We're seeing, you mentioned social impact investing. The investors who are looking at India at the moment, the great and the good of global investors, big pension funds, opportunistic investors. Again, it's another economy country where there is enormous growth, and there are a couple of cities which will really benefit in the next few years. Sector-wise, everyone talks about beds and sheds. Talked to big global investors. Beds and sheds is what is top of the list. Returns are very compressed in those areas. One area that I think hasn't developed, but I think will develop, is co-working investment, where you're not buying assets let to a WeWork or another, where you're actually carving up buildings into much smaller sections, heavily multi-let investments. I think we'll see high yield out of these things, harder to manage, and I think we'll start to see that as an asset class that's almost like a hotel, but for offices. And I think over the next 10 years that will potentially start to emerge.
Interesting stuff. And the same question to you, Sarah.
Yeah, well, I think sort of in an increasingly urbanized world, you know, our big cities are getting bigger, and a very common theme across the cities today, other than Tokyo, is that all are growing at a pretty rapid rate. So I think we have to acknowledge that, and certainly the work we're doing in Sydney is really trying to accommodate that growth, but not just more, to do it better and to recognize some pretty important fundamentals to how we live around heat, around making sure that cities are walkable, but also that we're managing some of those environmental impacts around carbon emissions and so forth. From a sort of an investment, you know, and a use point of view, I'm really fascinated by the we work, we live thinking. And in Sydney, certainly, we've been looking at more diverse forms of housing, more affordable housing forms through what we call new generation boarding accommodation, which is in effect a more compact form of housing closer to jobs, more diversity in terms of tenure and your ability to live in these locations. So it may be sort of a similar or akin to a WeWork, you know, sort of early concept in that regards. I'm also really fascinated, though, in how you best merge industrial areas with residential, and how we recognise that industrial is changing, that manufacturing is evolving, that we need higher order employment and industrial uses, and how you best integrate that with housing, because we need our land to work harder in our cities. And how do you recognise the fact that manufacturing isn't, as Jules Pipe was saying today, you know, tanning factories anymore within our cities? These are creative places, these are microbreweries, these are places where you know, people have computers and but need more space, and how you better manage that without blowing out land values. And by bringing residential in as a highest and best use, you can often override the merits of the area as an employment. And so how you have that vertical mix in cities other than Tokyo and places like that, where you have incredibly high values, is a really interesting challenge, I think, for cities such as Sydney going forward.
And it's interesting that you mention, you know, challenges there, and, you know, solving problems. And just to step away, I know this is, we're talking about investment today, but just to step away from that for just a second and talk about collaboration, because we've sort of been talking a bit around programs that have been set up to help bring mayors together, to help cities really learn from each other, and to help address some of these problems. I mean, some of them obviously are very city specific, but plenty aren't. And this idea of work, you know, it sounds very utopian, but sort of working together globally for all cities to rise together and to all be, you know, incredibly investable by tackling some of these problems head on collectively. Is that realistic? Do you think? We're going to see more of that, or are we still, you know, living in a world where people like to keep themselves where they can, and particularly where financial investment is involved? I'll come back to you, Sarah, on that, actually, because you're over from Sydney, so interesting to get your perspective.
Yeah, look, I think certainly the planning fraternity are very open in sharing lessons learned, challenges, joys, and it always amazes me how common the issues are, whether it's governance, whether it's housing affordability, whether it's transport and access to jobs and commute times. I mean, we're all facing very, very similar issues. We all operate in very different environments, so how we navigate navigate solutions to those issues is far more nuanced. But I definitely think there is a consistent and an increasing willingness to share those experiences and an international collaboration in that respect. For me, I just say collaboration is key to everything I do, and it never ceases to amaze me the power of bringing people around a table and talking about a place and connecting those dots rather than thinking about services or investment in infrastructure or development. It's actually about the power of recognising a place and the value of it, and that's certainly something in the last few years I've experienced firsthand, and the difference it can make by just, as I said, simply bringing people around a table and having that coalition of the willing to actually make things happen.
Thank you very much. David, what are your thoughts on that and collaboration between cities?
I don't have too much to add to that. I would say, yes, by all means, collaboration, a positive thing across cities, and where there are best practices should be shared. I do think, however, that cities should be aware of their own strengths, what makes them the city that they are, and certainly steer well clear of sort of a one-size-fits-all sort of approach. It's more difficult for the slightly smaller cities, which have to decide whether that's where their place lies or whether they want to grow and move into sort of the next tier. But I do think different cities have different characters, they have their different strengths, and to my mind, the ones that really succeed are the ones that stick with sort of those cores and really focus on that.
Thank you very much. And finally, Rashid, your thoughts on that too?
Not a huge amount to add, to be honest. I think I don't see massive collaboration between different cities. I don't see New York and London sort of working together. Maybe from a more of a governmental perspective, there'll be collaboration, but from a sort of investors are looking and owners of assets, etc., looking at they learn from other cities, but it's not necessarily a collaboration between the two. They're learning from the lessons of success in other places.
Okay, great. We've got about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to talk about the way that real estate and cities are changing, and you know how investors can sort of keep abreast of all of that. We've heard a lot about what's happening with building cities from the internet up, and I think that is sort of an overarching issue above a lot of things that are happening around technology and cities and the way that cities are changing, becoming more digital. Do you think that these changes are going to be a hindrance or a help when it comes to investability? And could I start, David? Could I start with you on that?
Yeah. So I mean, I think those changes are all very positive things. When it comes to the investor perspective, it's sort of understanding how those things really feed through at a fundamental level, and we are starting to see we're starting to get more help in terms of things like buildings being classified in different ways and being scored, so you know exactly what you're going to get. You can see how that affects values when properties transact, because without that, those quantitative measures and a track record of what they mean for returns and for risk, then that is a very difficult thing for an investor to take into account.
Mm. Thank you very much. Rashid?
I think there can only be a help. I agree with the point that it's very difficult for these things to be tangible from a pounds and pence perspective. I think it's defensive. If your buildings or your cities are not tech smart and up to scratch, then you will fall behind. People want top quality assets, facilities, amenities in all aspects of their life, and we have the transparency of information in everything we do that we can see very quickly whether something is subpar and average is not good enough and tolerated well in our society today.
Thank you very much. We have 1 minute, so I just wanted to go around and I'll start with you, Sarah. And I know that I already said earlier, and it's very difficult to predict the future, but just to finish off, just be really good to hear from all of you. If there's one thing, whether it be one trend, one area, one city, one thing that you'll be keeping your eye very firmly on over the next 3 to 6 months, what would that be?
That's a big question for a strategic planner who's writing plans for the next 20 to 40 years for cities. Look, it's a great one. For me, the big thing we're trying to do in Sydney, and this is incredibly difficult, and it's not the next 6 to 12 months, it's the next 20 to 40 years, is really trying to attract the right type of jobs to the city, because housing follows, retail follows, so much of that does, but trying to get the right types of business in the right types of spaces is the really difficult thing for a city planner, and so much of it comes back to creating the right places, and all of this takes time, it takes collaboration back to that point, and it takes people who are willing to take on risk and to make things happen as well and stick their neck out. So for me, so much of it flows from the right quality jobs in the right type of environment, but there's so much that goes into that equation to make it happen.
Thank you very much. And David?
Yeah, I think I would say from my perspective, looking at the UK, just that I do see lots of opportunities in London and in the regions in the UK at the moment. So the focus for the next 12 months probably is sort of trying to almost shine a light on them through all of the political uncertainty that we're facing.
What political uncertainty? Joking, of course. Rashid?
Brexit.
Oh, well, I mean, we are banning that word. We banned that word a while ago, but it's back again now.
For me, 3 to 6 months, political instability in the UK is a big problem for us in the world that we work in. And London is, if you're on the ground, you're working with tenants, letting buildings, etc., etc., there's a massive amount of activity that's happening, and the cloud of this politics is puts people off wrongly. And obviously for us in our world, the next 3 to 6 months, that is a key thing that we're watching.
Yes, I was making a bit of a joke there, because as you said it, we didn't quite have it turned up. But if anyone was in any doubt, the word was Brexit.
Yeah.
On which note, it's time to wrap up. Thank you so much to Sarah, David and Rashid for joining me today. It's been great, very insightful, and brilliant to hear from all of you, and particularly to have somebody over from Sydney to get that international perspective, which is so important for this particular podcast. But thank you all very much.